Journal and Madison.com. And without their support, this would not be possible. So thank them. Two more brief notes before getting started. Our host, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is committed to freedom of speech and freedom of expression as an essential part of the education mission. It's our expectation that you allow the speaker's presentation to occur without disruption. Any disruptions to the event will be handled swiftly by security. We also ask that you silence phones and refrain from flash photography. Now, onto the program. We are thrilled tonight to have as our moderator the great Peter Baker, Chief White House Correspondent for the New York Times. Peter appeared last night at our journalism fundraiser with his wife and fellow journalist Susan Glasser of the New Yorker in a great conversation moderated by David Marinus. The event was superb, and Peter agreed to stick around to moderate this conversation, and for that, we are deeply appreciative. I told him when I read the print front page of the New York Times, I always kind of seek out his byline for some of the most erudite political reporting you'll find anywhere. His wife, Susan, joked that I must be a journalist. His participation makes the night even more special. It was exactly a year ago on this stage that we hosted Adam Kinzinger, who talked about his, yeah, it was a great night, he talked about his journey as a conservative Republican congressman whose conscience forced him to put aside ideology and devote himself to the defeat of Trump and Trumpism. Tonight, we welcome another American hero, a woman with unparalleled political courage and selflessness. I spoke to Wisconsin Democratic Chairman Ben Wickler today, who would be here tonight, except, as all of you know, for the Harris visit that we did not know about. And so we would have had all the Democratic leaders in the state here, but that wasn't possible. But he said, please, Paul, publicly thank her for her patriotism. And I thought that was pretty cool. In a fundraising letter for Representative Cheney's PAC called Our Great Task, she writes, it's time for all of us to put love of country ahead of partisanship, to stand together for our values and our freedoms in the face of a threat we've never faced before. With that, please welcome Liz Cheney and Peter Baker to our stage.
You're listening to the Cap Times Idea Fest in Madison, featuring Liz Cheney on Civic Media.
All right, I'm feeling bad for the other event in town, obviously. Nobody must have showed up there. Thank you guys for coming.
That event. Important.
Well, thank you guys for showing up, and thank you for that very warm welcome for Congresswoman Cheney. We're going to have a fun time tonight. As Paul just mentioned, she is, of course, a Madison native, so she's coming home, which is a great thing. No Badgers. And I want to read you a little of a letter that was sent to Liz Cheney on August the 1st, 1966. I think you were 4 days old, is that right?
That sounds right, yep.
All right. From Governor Warren Knowles, I think this is probably your very first communication with an elected official. And he wrote, Dear Elizabeth Lynn, I want to personally welcome you to the state of Wisconsin. Your arrival has been long awaited, and I join with your mother and dad in their enthusiasm. I can hardly wait to meet you and see whether you are as pretty and sweet as your mother and as smart and personable as your dad.
It was 1966.
Well, I would actually love to hear their reflections on that. But Governor Knowles obviously is not with us anymore, but if I could be so presumptuous, I'm sure Wisconsin welcomes you back. Thank you, Liz, for being here
thank
tonight.
Thank you. Awesome. It's wonderful to be back, and it's interesting, actually, because when I was born, my mom and dad were students at the University of Wisconsin, and my mother actually was in the PhD program, and she got her PhD, My father was in the PhD program, and he never got his PhD. So proving that Governor Knowles...
But I think your father is pretty and sweet
anyway. He did okay. Yeah, he did okay.
Well, I feel a little like a third wheel here, because 2 weeks ago with our friend Peter Fever at Duke, you made some news. And then a few days later with our friend Mark Leibovich in Texas, you made some news. And I, you know, of course, everybody knows what the news was, right? That she announced she's going to vote for Kamala Harris. And then she announced that on behalf of her father, he was going to vote for Kamala Harris. And so you haven't left me with a lot. So I guess I'm going to ask, who's your mom voting for?
Well, I think you can guess, but I actually have not checked with her this afternoon if she feels all right with me making that announcement today. And as we were just discussing, Lynn Cheney is actually really the tough one in the family. So I think I should check with her before I publicly
don't get in trouble. I don't want to get you in trouble
announce.
Here. I don't want to get in trouble here.
But it won't be surprising.
Well, talk a little bit though for a minute. You have made this announcement in the last couple of weeks. You cast your first vote, I think, 40 years ago, 1984, for a Republican, Ronald Reagan, and have never voted for a Democrat for president. So this is an extraordinary thing to do. I don't think people should underestimate what it means for a lifelong Republican to make this kind of a decision that you've made. But what do you think about other Republicans who haven't joined you yet? I think of President Bush, who was your father's partner for 8 years. We know he doesn't like or doesn't think much of President Trump and yet hasn't said anything publicly. What about Mitt Romney? And, you know, Wisconsinite Paul Ryan, there are a lot of Republicans whose voices are important. Do you think they will speak out, should speak out? Have you ever spoken to them about why they don't?
Well, I think that I would put people, I suppose, in different categories. And I don't want to criticize the people that you've mentioned, all of whom, you know, have been very clear about their views with respect to the former president. I do think it's important if you look at President Bush, he clearly endorsed the Republican nominee in 2008, clearly did that in 2012, and has never endorsed Donald Trump. And I think that says something. You know, my decision to not just work to make sure that we defeat Donald Trump, but as part of that, to announce that I was going to vote for Vice President Harris was something I thought about very deeply. And I thought about it from the perspective of doing everything we possibly can to make sure that we defeat former President Trump. And particularly, in my view, in swing states like Wisconsin, I don't think it's enough if you're voting in one of those states to say, well, I'm just going to write in a conservative Republican. I'm going to write in somebody that I'd like to see in office. I think this is going to be an incredibly, potentially incredibly close race. I hope it's not, but it could be. And so it really, really matters. If you really believe, as I do, that Donald Trump is too dangerous ever again to be near the Oval Office, then I think that it's incumbent upon us to go the extra step and actually cast a vote for Vice President Harris.
Well, I'm curious what you think of people who worked in the Trump administration as well, because there are people like John Kelly and Jim Mattis and Rex Tillerson and others who have made clear, what, as you say, that they didn't think much of President Trump. They didn't think he was fit for office. They themselves, of course, have not come out in this election season as you have. Do you think that they would or should, or would you call them or talk to them about that? Because I think that one of the questions a lot of Republicans might have, they may not know what it was like to actually be in that White House, and these are people who can tell them.
Yeah, look, I think, first of all, you've had an unprecedented number of officials who served in the Trump administration who have said they will never support him again. And I think we've become so numb to kind of the unprecedented nature and the chaotic and sometimes violent nature of our politics now that it's really important to stop and think about what that means. When those who were working most closely with the former president refused to support him, that's something that everyone needs to stop and think about. I think that, you know, I certainly hope that you will see additional, and I would expect you will see additional of the people who served in those in his administration to come out and say publicly what they've seen. Some of them certainly have. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, in the case of some of the people that you mentioned, for example, you know, General Kelly has been absolutely clear in confirming on the record what he observed and Donald Trump's lack of fitness for office. And you've heard similar things from some of the other people. So, look, I do think it's important. I think one of the things that I've certainly seen around the country in the aftermath of January 6th in particular was, you know, when Republican leaders think that they can sort of keep their head down or that someone else is going to take care of the problem, then I think that can lead voters to think it's not as serious as it is. And so when you have Republican elected officials who in private say exactly what, you know, what we all know to be the case, those elected officials, I think, have a duty, have a responsibility to speak out. I think at the at the end of the day, because it's a secret ballot, I think that people will be surprised at how many Republicans, when they go in and actually have to face just their own conscience, will do the right thing and will not vote for President Trump.
We're working to make a little news here. In Texas, you went beyond the presidential race and talked about Colin Allred, who's running for Senate against Ted Cruz. Since we're here in your home state, I wonder if you have any thoughts about Congressman Derek Van Orden, who was actually at the Capitol on January 6, 2021. He says he didn't go inside. Do you have any feelings about that race?
Yeah, look, I think that any time that we have elected officials who are election deniers, who have made clear that they'll only accept the results of an election if they like the outcome. You know, I think that those are certainly not people who would earn my vote. You know, I think that a big part of what we have to do as a country, and especially in states like Wisconsin, is remember and reflect on how important these offices are. And so you can't just sort of reflexively think, especially now, well, I'm going to vote for the Republican because I'm a Republican. I think you really do have to think through, you know, who's going to be the serious person who is going to operate in good faith and fulfill their obligations. So I'm not making endorsement announcements. I'm sorry, Peter, but I wouldn't vote for Van Orden.
Okay. That's something. And because my friends in the Wisconsin press would be mad if I didn't ask, how about Eric Hovde, who's running for Senate against Tammy Baldwin? I could ask.
No.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
And let me, you know, I think it's when you look at the House of Representatives and the races and how close that margin is, and the same is true in the Senate in terms of how close it is, And you look at the responsibility of the House and the Senate in particular on January 6, 2025, you know, the Republicans, and I say this, makes me very sad that this is the case, but the Republicans have shown that they will not certify the results if Donald Trump isn't the victor. And so I think that it's really important that Mike Johnson not be the Speaker of the House on January 6, 2025.
I think you and I are basically the same age. I voted for the first time in 1984,
Did you vote for Reagan?
I'm not saying who I voted for, and I And I don't vote anymore. Actually, I haven't voted since I started covering the White House in 1996. I decided I was going to stop voting, just for myself, to try to be as I know. We can talk about that later.
What state do you vote in?
Well, I'm in the District of Columbia, so it doesn't make a difference anyway, okay? I mean, Trump got 4% in the District of Columbia, and if, you know, my vote wouldn't make a difference if I was for him or against him. But in any case, my point, all right.
No.
I walked into that one. We can talk about that later. This is about Liz Cheney. But I want to talk about Republicanism, because the Republicans I covered as a young reporter all the way through, I covered your father, I covered President Bush, I wrote a book about them, I wrote about President Bush 41 in another book, and James Baker, his partner, Mitt Romney, John McCain, covered them, knew them. Tell me about the Republican Party today. We've got the Lauren Boberts and Marjorie Taylor Greene, and now we have Mark Robinson, who calls himself a black Nazi, and advocates the return of slavery, and on a pornographic website, and we can go into even more graphic details that we don't need to. So how is it that that has happened? What is, why has the Republican Party embraced or at least tolerated people who would never gotten in the front door 10 years ago, 12 years ago?
Yeah, you know, it happened very quickly. You know, if you think about probably January 2019, maybe it was around the end of 2018, beginning of 2019, there was a Republican member of the House from Iowa named Steve King, who made comments, that indicated some level of support for apparently white nationalism. And as soon as he did that, as soon as the news broke, those of us, I was in Republican leadership at the time, immediately, you know, Steve King was stripped of his committee assignments immediately. And if you just look at the difference between the way, you know, that was Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise and I were the top three officials at that point, the way we dealt with Steve King, and then you just fast forward to, you know, to 2020, 2021, and the extent to which voices in the party, you know, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who, you know, among other things, talks about Jewish space lasers, and it's a, you know, at the meeting of the Republican conference a few weeks after January 6th, when I was speaking to the conference, you know, I talked about the symbols that the mob carried into the Capitol, and of course, you know, they were there in Trump's name, and they carried his flags, and they used those flags to beat police officers, and they had other weapons with them. But they also had symbols of anti-Semitism. They had symbols of racism and bigotry, and you know, what I was saying to my colleagues at the time was, we have to choose. You know, are we going to be the party that glorifies that, or are we going to be the party of Lincoln? And we have to reject those things. And what you have seen is the party has chosen not to reject those things. And when you have, you know, just in the last few weeks, Tucker Carlson interviewing someone that he calls, I think, one of the most important historians of World War II. And this individual on Tucker's platform said that Winston Churchill was the greatest villain of World War II. And he said that Hitler didn't really want to fight. And this kind of, you know, anti-Semitism that Tucker promoted, it's, you know, really Nazi propaganda. Then J.D. Vance, who, you know, after this had happened, obviously nobody in a leadership role should be giving interviews to Tucker, but they all still are. J.D. Vance did an interview with Tucker, I think, 2 days after he platformed this guy spreading Nazi propaganda. And so that's really partly what's happened to the party. And then, you know, look, it's, I think, one of the great untold stories of this period of our history will be of the collaborators, the people who are elected, who know better, who absolutely know Donald Trump's dangerous. They absolutely know what he believes in and stands for as him, that he's willing to tolerate some of the worst kinds of bigotry, and that he doesn't believe in the Constitution, but yet they are going along anyway.
We're always curious about this. If you took a secret ballot of these elected Republicans in Congress, like, how many of them do you think really actually genuinely agree with you but just won't say so, or are afraid to say so, or for whatever reason don't speak out?
Well, I think the vast majority. I mean, you know, there are very few elected officials who actually believe what Trump is saying. But there's a, you know, sort of once you've accepted, once you've told yourself, I'm going to accept just this one last offense, just this one last thing, then it becomes very difficult to come back from that because, you know, very quickly you accept more and more and more of it. And I think that, you know, those are the people who, have created a situation where Trump is obviously taken over the Republican Party. And the party itself really has rejected the Constitution in the name of supporting Trump. And I think, you know, those people will bear tremendous responsibility and blame when history looks back at this time.
Well, okay, as we said earlier, obviously across town right now, there's another event that's not as interesting as this one. You haven't appeared with Vice President Harris, even though you've endorsed her. Have you spoken with her? Is there any thinking about whether you might go to a rally like that?
I have spoken to Vice President Harris, and I'm sorry, Peter.
You didn't take notes?
Look, I'm going to do everything that I can, because I think it's so important. So stay tuned.
Okay. All right. Without giving anything away that you don't want to give away, did she call you? Did you call her? Come on, I'm a reporter.
I know. listen, we had a very good discussion, and I believe that she knows this coalition that's coming together to support her is such a broad one, and such an unusual one. I mean, I'll admit, the story I'm going to tell you has a number of admissions in it. One is that I was watching MSNBC yesterday. and I couldn't resist. I took a picture of the Chyron at the bottom because it said, Dick Cheney and Taylor Swift support Kamala Harris.
Which one is more surprised?
but in all seriousness, I mean, this coalition that is backing Vice President Harris is unique, certainly in modern political history. And I think it really goes to, and this is the point, you know, she understands that she has to be a president for all Americans. This isn't, you know, sort of all of these people coming together saying we believe 100% in the policies of the Democratic Party, because that's not the case. But I think there are a lot more places we agree than not, and there's something far more important in this race than policy differences.
I mean, people should remember a lot of your fellow Republicans who have broken with Trump and moved. They've actually moved on their philosophy in some cases. Actually, some of them become much more liberal. But you're still a conservative, right? You still call yourself a conservative. Do you call yourself a Republican?
Yeah. I'm a conservative. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to point out that, you know, because I have this discussion sometimes with Republicans who will suggest that they're backing Trump because Trump is a conservative, and he's not. There was an analysis, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal actually in the last couple of days, about whose economic policy would be better for the country. This is a Wall Street Journal. And on balance, they said Kamala Harris's. You know, when you look at Donald Trump, now, I have disagreements with, you know, her tax policy and a number of other things, but people need to focus on Donald Trump's tariff policy. And the thing that I think hasn't gotten enough attention about the tariffs is obviously the extent to which we know how damaging tariffs will be for every single American, the kind of tariffs that he's talking about, the extent to which they could crater our markets and choke off free trade. He doesn't need Congress to do that. You know, a president of the United States, through executive action, can impose the kind of really damaging tariffs he's talking about. Not to mention, like, every single day he's tossing out some new free thing. He says he's, you know, I don't know what the latest one is. But so on economic policy, I think there's real question about what he's proposing. And on national security policy, he's completely abandoned the notion that America has to lead the world, and he's invited Putin to invade our NATO allies. I mean, that is not anything consistent with any kind of conservative national security policy that I've ever been aware of.
What did you think of the debate last week between the two of them?
I thought that that the vice president did a tremendous job, and I think about this sometimes as I try to put myself in the position of somebody who isn't swimming in the politics of it the way that we do. And, you know, I think if you just were watching that debate as somebody who's thinking, all right, you know, who do I want to entrust with the future of the country? Who do I trust? Who's the responsible adult? Like, you know, there was no contest.
Yeah. People will remember that debate as they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats debate. We talked a lot this year, obviously, about age and politics. We talked a lot about President Biden's age and capacity, and obviously it was a factor in Democrats asking him to step down and him agreeing to do it. What do you think about Donald Trump's age and capacity? Do you notice a difference watching that debate, watching his rallies, if you do that? Do you see a different Donald Trump than he has been? Is he? Is there something there that we should be thinking about?
Well, look, I mean, he's clearly unstable. I think he obviously is incredibly desperate and depraved. And I think if you look at the dogs and the cats lie. I mean, it really is, you know, apparently J.D. Vance sort of launched this attack, and they checked with the local government in Springfield, Ohio, and they were told it's not true. And they kept saying it anyway. And what they're saying is, creating real animosity and bigoted feelings towards the Haitian community in Springfield. And I have thought, as I've watched them do this, that it's very much like, you know, the lie about the election. It doesn't matter that it isn't true. It's just, and J.D. Vance even said it. He said, yeah, well, if I have to create something, I will. So we really, like, you know, need to understand the use of lying and the danger of that in what they're doing and what they're willing to do as we think about November 5th.
Well, you mentioned what they're willing to do. Not that long ago, the former president reposted a tweet or a post, whatever it was, suggesting that you had committed treason and that you should be put on trial in a military tribunal. Putting aside the legal, constitutional, you know, issues there, how do you react to that? And do you worry for your own safety, for your own, for you and your family if he wins the election?
Well, you know, when I saw that, and I think I responded to it saying, you know, look, this is just the latest episode, the latest example, Donald, that shows the American people that you're not fit to be president. And so I don't think about it from a personal perspective as much as I do from the perspective of trying to make sure that the voters understand what he's doing and what he would do. And this, you know, look, he tried it before, you know. There's a new show on, I can't remember which streaming service it is, but it's called Stopping the Steal. I think it just came out in the last couple of days. It's worth watching because it reminds you again of everything that he did to try to overturn the election and seize power. And overturn the election means throw out the votes of millions of Americans, you know, throw out the votes of Wisconsinites who decided that, you know, Joe Biden should prevail, that Joe Biden won this state. He wanted to throw out your votes. And he will do it again. And he's totally untethered to the law. If you think about the fact that our court system, which sometimes people say, well, the courts will constrain Trump. The courts, they can't enforce their own decisions. And so if a president is unwilling to enforce the rulings of the courts, then we aren't a nation of laws. And this most recent Supreme Court decision on immunity, like, you know, no matter what the court seems to have thought they were doing, what they have done is created a situation where Donald Trump, were he to be in office again, would believe that he could do anything and that he would be absolutely immune from any kind of accountability. And the danger to that, you just have to listen to the guy. I mean, like, I keep trying to find ways to say to people, you know, like, if you wouldn't hire the guy, like, if you, you know, wouldn't let him watch your children, then, you know, he probably shouldn't be your choice for president. Like, let's, you know.
Did we miss an opportunity, we collectively in Washington or this country, to fix some of the holes in the system that his tenure revealed? You talked, I think, recently about the Electoral Count Act. So obviously Congress did change some things about how the Electoral College votes are counted and in order to avoid any confusion and minimize the disruption of last time. But we didn't, there was nothing that was done by Congress or anybody else on the Justice Department to make it independent of political prosecutions, right? And there wasn't anything done on the Insurrection Act to make clear that it's not meant to put troops in the streets because you don't like the people who are protesting or something like that. I mean, after Watergate, there was at least a period of reform. Some of the reforms didn't work and they've kind of gone away, but there hasn't really been that same kind of reaction by the system to adjust. And where does that leave us?
Yeah, I think, first of all, with respect to the Electoral Count Act, I think it's really important to make clear that what he did was illegal under the previous act and unconstitutional, and it would be illegal, unconstitutional under the reformed act. Some of the things that we did was increase, for example, the numbers of members required for an objection to be heard. But I do think that ultimately as a nation, the reality is that we could put sort of all of the obstacles, all of the roadblocks in place that you could think of, all of the guardrails. But if you elect somebody who doesn't care and someone who has shown us all, he's shown us all because he did it before. If you elect that person, it doesn't matter how many guardrails you have in place because they will blow through them. And I think this is an important point, you know, again, friends of mine who are Republicans who are struggling with this sort of, or try to tell themselves, it'll be fine, you know, if he's reelected, we'll be able to control him. You know, that is a really irresponsible fantasy. And just look at...
You're listening to the Cap Times Idea Fest in Madison, featuring Liz Cheney on Civic Media.
The Senate and the House that the Republicans have done and have allowed him to do. I mean, you know, he didn't want the bipartisan border legislation, so Republicans rejected it, even though they had negotiated it. And you see that again and again. And if you think to yourself, you know, is Mike Johnson or Tom Cotton or Marco Rubio, are those guys going to stand up to Donald Trump? Of course not. It really matters. Character really matters. And the people that we put in these offices, especially the presidency, if you elect someone who isn't going to defend the Constitution, then the survival of the republic is at risk. And that's where we are in this election.
worth remembering that you mentioned J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance said specifically that they should adopt the Andrew Jackson approach to the Supreme Court, which is to say the Supreme Court has made its ruling, now let it enforce it.
Yeah.
In other words, we won't listen to the Supreme Court if it says something we don't agree with.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, Mike Pence deserves tremendous gratitude for not succumbing to the pressure of Donald Trump on January 6, 2021. And, you know, J.D. Vance was clearly picked, and he said, you know, as much, that he would reject the electoral votes. He talked about, well, I would just tell the states they needed to look at it again. And, you know, there's no constitutional authority for the vice president to say, you know, I don't like this outcome, so try again, states. But he specifically was chosen by Donald Trump because he will do that. And I think that also needs to guide people's decisions about how they vote.
Now, the January 6th committee on which you were vice chair was widely hailed. The investigation added an awful lot, I think, to the record of that event, not just on January 6th, but importantly on the days and weeks and months really leading up to it. Because I think that a lot of people missed the idea that it wasn't just a one-off day, that this was building and building through the pressure on the Justice Department, the pressure on state officials, the pressure on the vice president. And that he had signaled this even before the election. People forget that, too. He told us before the election, if I lose, it will be because it was rigged, which, of course, is now what he's saying again. Looking back on the January 6th committee, is there something that you didn't do that you would have liked to have done? Or is there anything you would have done differently now that you've had some time to reflect on it?
There's nothing that I can point to that I would say, you know, I wish we'd done that differently. You know, obviously, I wish I had never supported Donald Trump. That's sort of outside the bounds of the committee's work. But that's my regret. When I think about the work the committee did, I'm incredibly proud of what we did. And it was totally unprecedented and I really did find myself again through this period of the first 6 months or so of 2021, just kind of stunned by my Republican colleagues because after every major sort of crisis in our nation's history, you know, the notion of forming some sort of bipartisan commission to make recommendations is something that we've done. We did it after Watergate, did it after Pearl Harbor, after 9/11. And so that was the model that initially we followed, and initially Kevin McCarthy supported, and actually, you know, told...
So did Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, right.
Before they didn't.
I mean, and that's, you know, how do you not investigate an attack on the Congress? I don't know how you justify not investigating it, but they killed the idea of an outside bipartisan commission. And so the Select Committee was the only way we had to actually do the investigation. And, it was really important, we felt, to make sure, first of all, that the story of what had happened, you know, as we did the investigation and interviewed Republican witnesses again and again and again, it was clear this story has to be told by those Republicans. You know, this isn't Donald Trump's political opponents saying he refused to tell the mob to leave, saying he didn't actually want to do anything. Those are the people inside the White House. And that's why, frankly, he's working so hard to suppress the evidence in his January 6th criminal trial. Because he doesn't want the American people to hear the testimony that those people gave to the grand jury. Now, the Select Committee developed a significant amount of evidence, but the special counsel has developed even more. And Donald Trump has everything that we all did, and he knows what these people said in their grand jury testimony. He doesn't want the American people to know it. But again, you know, just the extent to which people should remember this wasn't his political opponent saying these things. It was the people and his family.
His family.
Working most closely with him.
Yeah, no, I think that's important to remember. You mentioned regretting supporting him. Talk about your own journey a little bit, because you did endorse him in 2016 and endorsed him in 2020, and you voted against the first impeachment and so forth. You were more outspoken from time to time than most of your colleagues even then, when he said things that were, you felt outrageous, when he said we shouldn't even have the election in 2024 because of COVID and so forth. You did speak out. But we interviewed Adam Kinzinger once for our book on Trump called The Divider, available at all bookstores near you.
It's a great book.
And he said something really interesting to us, which I was fascinated. We asked him, okay, why did you vote against the first impeachment? He says, look, I was open to voting for it, but I just was looking for a reason not to. It was easier for me to stay with my party, and so I latched on to the criticism of the Democrats and how they handled it, and they didn't handle it well, and they should have done this or that. I had a better inquiry, and I let that be my excuse. In effect, he's saying, I'm not quoting him directly, but something like that, for sticking with my party, and I regret it. I thought there was a fascinating insight into the psychology of politics, right? Because we are in this tribal moment. It's us versus them. And sticking with us is the easier course, right? And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I have a different view about the first impeachment than what you mentioned. And I have huge respect, obviously, he's a dear friend of mine, for Adam. But the first impeachment, I think that one of the real problems, and I looked at this from the perspective of, this is a very serious and grave constitutional obligation that we have as members of the House to decide to vote to impeach. And because the Democrats who were in the majority on the committee didn't pursue testimony of some of the key people, I felt that they hadn't made the case. Now, if they had gotten that testimony and put it on, things may well have been different, but it also very much guided me as we worked on the Select Committee, because I knew, you know, there was this debate that went on where some people were saying, well, you know, you shouldn't have an aggressive litigation strategy as part of the Select Committee's work, because if you lose, then, you know, that will have an impact on the institution of the House. And my view throughout was, nothing has a greater impact on the institution of the House than failing to fully investigate this attack on the House. And so I believed it was very important for us to issue subpoenas, to pursue those subpoenas aggressively in litigation, pursue enforcement of those subpoenas. And to her great credit, Speaker Pelosi, you know, first of all, she appointed me to the committee, which, you know, I'm sure wasn't easy for her in some respects. But when she was thinking about appointing me, one of her staff members handed her a piece of paper that said, the top 10 worst things Liz Cheney has ever said about Nancy Pelosi.
It's amazing they narrowed it down.
I mean, you know, it's like, wow, I'm glad they stopped at 10. But But she, you know, look, she took the piece of paper, she looked at it, and she said, why are you bothering me with things that don't matter? And handed it back to the staffer. And so so she had appointed me to the committee, and every single time I went to her with any sort of issue or question or request, she backed me up every time. And I think that's... it's really important. So, you know, the extent to which, I suppose it's kind of a different issue, kind of the extent to which we're in, you know, opposing camps or something, you know, that guides how people operate in politics. It certainly guides it in a way that it shouldn't. And I do think people get on autopilot. Absolutely, you know, if you're in Congress, if you're a Republican in Congress, you know, and the Democrats propose legislation, the tendency is, okay, well, what are the worst things we can say about that legislation? And the same the other way around. And I think, you know, I certainly hope that having been through what we've been through, we can all say, wait a minute, like we need to recognize we'll have differences, but stop the reflexive partisan attacks, because it doesn't... It's not good for the country.
I I was very struck that on January 6th, 2022, when you and your father showed up on the House floor to commemorate the one-year anniversary of the attack, the only Republicans who were there, and Nancy Pelosi, I think, hugged your father, right? And I have to say, I covered those days, and if you had told Nancy Pelosi of 2006 that she would be hugging Dick Cheney and vice versa,
I
think heads would have exploded.
Yeah. Now, the person that we ran into as soon as we walked onto the House floor that day was actually Adam Schiff, which is the same kind of, you know, kind of worlds colliding. But that day, you know, my dad and I sat down in the front row on the Republican side of the aisle as the moment of silence and the commemoration began. And my dad, he had not been back on the House floor since January 6th, since before January 6th, but he sort of looked behind us and he saw all of the empty seats, and he turned back to me and he said, you know, it's one thing to hear about and to read about what's happened to our party, but the fact that there's no other Republicans, none, here, was really... really just kind of a shocking thing to actually see it, I think, firsthand.
Yeah. I mean, you said to Peter Fever at Duke, you said you're looking forward to the day when you can be booed by liberals again. which by which you mean, of course, that we would be back to a normal politics where we could have fights about issues and not this kind of moment. But is it uncomfortable? You forge this relationship with Nancy Pelosi that seems unlikely. I mean, does it feel uncomfortable for you as a conservative, lifelong Republican, that you're being embraced by Democrats and that so many of your own party aren't willing to?
It feels to me, you know, like we've had this shift in our politics, but as a conservative, there's never been any question for me about, you know, you have to take the step that is defense of the Constitution. Like, the most important thing is defense of the Constitution. And so if that means, you know, yes, I mean, it is obviously a little discombobulating sometimes. But I think there's a really important lesson too. And I think that lesson is we have to listen to each other. And it goes back to the reflexive partisanship. You know, we have to conduct ourselves, and members of Congress should be incentivized. You know, let's sit down and talk across the aisle and learn from each other. And, you know, maybe you'll convince me or maybe I'll convince you. But the reflexive partisanship is, you know, we have to get away from it. I'm sure, you know, the Democratic members of the Select Committee thought it was just as weird to be sitting there with me. So I was like,
you are in this position where you have made this extraordinary break with your party's nominee, and you're supporting the nominee of the other party. I wonder how far it goes beyond Trump. Trump is this, in your view, as you've described him, a unique threat to the Constitution. Would it apply if it had been Nikki Haley or Ron DeSantis or some other Republican who ran but didn't win? If they had won the nomination, would you still be here supporting the Democratic nominee?
I certainly have my issues with the people you mentioned, but I don't believe that they would pose the threat that Donald Trump poses. I mean, it's only Donald Trump who has said you can terminate the Constitution and who has actually tried to do so. But I would say that there are others in the party who, you know, can't be trusted with power. And those are the people that we've talked about who are election deniers. So Trump presents a really, you know, a uniquely grave threat to the Republic in this election cycle, and that's why he has to be beaten at the polls. And I think that's very important to be clear that that's the response, is to make sure that he's defeated at the polls. But as a country and as a people, I do think we have to hold elected officials to account if they have been willing to go along with what he's done, if they've perpetuated the big lie. And so I think once we get past this election, hopefully, you know, we will beat him. But then I do think that there's got to be an effort. It's hard for me to see how the Republican Party survives because it's been so corrupted. But you know, we need two strong parties in this country, and so we'll have to figure out how we move forward.
Can I just clarify? So you're saying that while you have differences with Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis, it would not have necessarily meant that you would have broken with them. You might have been able to support them as a nominee had they gone forward, because you don't believe they would do what Trump did.
I mean, look, I don't believe that we have had. I think that Donald Trump presents a particularly unique danger.
Okay. Now, let me ask you about that phrase you just said, a particularly unique danger, because, of course, we've seen two assassination attempts now in the last 2 months against former President Trump. He says that phrases like that have instigated the violence. And, of course, at the same time, he says in the very same interview that the Democrats are trying to destroy the country and their enemies within. So it's we can talk about his rhetoric. Where is that line as far as you're concerned? Where is the line on political rhetoric beyond which we don't want to go? Because there is this volatile moment out there where there are clearly people who are unhinged or taking things seriously. We don't know the motivations of either of the two people, really. We can guess on the last one, maybe more than the first one. But how do you feel about this moment? Because we are in a period where political violence seems to be more relevant in our lives, and where is the responsibility of an elected official or former elected official in terms of our rhetoric?
Yeah, look, I think it's incumbent on all of us to be clear that violence has no place in our politics. But I think what Donald Trump is doing is getting it exactly backwards and trying to prevent people from being very clear about the threat that he poses. You know, there's only one candidate in this race. There's only one American president in history who mobilized a mob that he knew was armed and sent them to attack the Capitol. And, you know, again, the response to that has to be to defeat him at the ballot box in November. And I think that that it's really important to speak the truth about what he did. And the truth about what he did is what makes him so dangerous if he were to be elected again. And I think that, you know, if you have any question about what he did, just go back and look at what he did during the 187 minutes. I mean, that is the story of watching the mob assault the Capitol in his name, brutally beat police officers in his name, and have family members and his most senior supporters and advisors pleading with him to say something, to tell the mob to go home, and that he wouldn't do it. And he watched it on television. He was sitting in his dining room watching it on television. And, you know, just if you go back and look at the testimony that we took in the select committee, you know, we know, for example, that he was handed a note while he was watching it on television, and the note said a civilian had been shot at the entrance to the chamber of the House of Representatives, and he still wouldn't tell the mob to go home. And we also know that when he tweeted at 2:24 that Mike Pence didn't have the courage, in Trump's words, to do what Trump wanted him to do, about 10 minutes after that tweet went out, the mob, the crowd surged forward, both inside the Capitol and on the West Front, and the Metropolitan Police line that had been holding the armed mob back broke at that point. It was the first time in the history of the Metropolitan Police Department that one of their lines broke in that fashion. He knew what he was doing. He didn't want the mob to stop because they were accomplishing his purposes. And you just have to, again, look at the testimony of the people who were there. So I think it's really important for people to speak the truth about that level of human depravity so that we don't elect him again.
We're running out of time here. I don't want to leave this unfinished. It raises the question, though, of if he is beaten, what does it mean for the future of the Republican Party? It's been written that he has to, that the Democrats have to win by such a large margin, not just to keep there from being any doubt about his defeat, but also to convince the party to purge itself of Trump. Can the party purge itself of Trump? Is that something that can happen?
You know, I think the way that I think about it, and this is based upon spending a lot of my time traveling around the country and talking to people, Republicans and Democrats and independents, that we need our political system to reflect the goodness of the American people. And that, you know, I think the majority, I don't have any question, that the majority of Americans don't want somebody like Donald Trump to be the president. The majority of Americans really would like to have a president that their kids can look up to. They really would like a president they know is going to defend the peaceful transfer of power. And I think that's where we have to start. Whether it's organizing a new party, it's hard for me to see how the Republican Party, given what it has done, can make the argument convincingly or credibly that people ought to be voting for Republican candidates until it really recognizes what it's done. And so I think, you know, making sure that on an individual basis we're casting votes for serious, responsible people, that we're encouraging people to get involved and run, there is certainly going to be a big shift, I think, in how our politics work. I don't know exactly what that will look like. I don't think it will just simply be, well, the Republican Party is going to put up a new, you know, slate of candidates and right off to the races. I think far too much has happened that's too damaging.
Well, so the Republican Party was actually born out of the ashes of a failed party. Are you thinking then there has to be a new party here that you're just suggesting just now, right?
I mean, it may well be because, again, you know, so much of the Republican Party today has allowed itself to become a tool for this really unstable man. And so it certainly has moved away from standing for anything of substance, anything of policy. And I think, you know, we're going to have some entity that actually, you know, can be making the case for the kinds of conservative causes that I believe in terms of a strong national defense and limited government and low taxes, the things that have represented the Republican Party before Trump.
Mm-hmm. Last question. I think people, when I travel, not as much as you do, I find that they're hungry for optimism. They're hungry for good news, right? It's been a tough number of years for a lot of Americans, for a lot of reasons, economics, their own economics, obviously, as well as politics and so forth. What makes you optimistic? What are you, in your travels, what are you learning or what are you seeing? What makes you feel positive about where things are going, given how dark the conversation often is?
Yeah, look, I feel very optimistic about the extent to which people are mobilized and motivated and understand how important it is to get out on November 5th and starting now in a number of states. And I feel very optimistic about the option that we have, very optimistic about the fact that we actually, you know, can beat Donald Trump in this election cycle. And if you think about, I mean, we all have been through you know, a period of time where people sort of say, I don't want anything to do with politics if that's what politics looks like. But, you know, it's happened in a you know, what is it, about an 8-year period, I suppose. We can fix it. And the fact that we live in a republic, that we live in a country where we get to do that, where we have the chance to do it, where we can show the whole world who we are and that we actually believe in our democracy and in optimism and hope. You know, it feels to me like that's the path that we're headed down. And I think then we can rebuild and build something better out of this.
Well, on that note, thank you very much, Liz Cheney, for taking the time. Welcome home to Madison. We'll be right back.